My name is Brad Holt. The title of this session is C.S. Lewis on Prayer. So we're going to have a bit of C.S. Lewis and we're going to have a bit of prayer. But I'm interested to know what attracted you to this session. And if I were to divide, if I ask you to divide the topic, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand if you are more interested in C.S. Lewis or if you're more interested in prayer. What is it that attracted you to this session? That's what I'm asking you to think about. All right, you have a tentative idea. It's not that it's a world-shaking decision or anything like that. But how many of you think you probably came because of C.S. Lewis in the title? How many of you came mainly because it was about prayer? Okay, the majority of you are more attracted by Lewis, and the minority of you by prayer. Yes?
The reason I was attracted to the C.S. Lewis was that I really became engaged by him again after seeing Shadowlands.
Yes.
And so that part of C.S. Lewis, we transformed, converted in a sense, newly converted. C.S. Lewis is the one who really attracts me.
Okay. So the C.S. Lewis of The Problem of Pain of 1940, as John Schramm was saying the other day, is a different C.S. Lewis from the one who has gone through falling in love and losing his wife to death. Let me start then by saying a few words about Lewis for any of you who don't know him very well. Clive Staples Lewis was born in Belfast in 1898. He died in 1963 on the very same day that John Kennedy died. In between, he was a very bright scholar and attended Oxford University and eventually was appointed a lecturer or fellow there of Magdalen or Magdalen College. Before that, he had been a soldier in the First World War and had been injured. And coming back from that war, he experienced his conversion to Christianity. He had been more or less talked out of his childhood faith by a tutor during his, I suppose, what would be about our junior high and high school part of his life. His tutor was an atheist, and he came to be an atheist himself. Then in the 20s, he came, as he says himself, in Surprised by Joy, his spiritual autobiography. Kicking and screaming, he came to faith in Christ. It's a kind of story that suggests that although it appears to us, especially in a college setting like mine where I teach at Augsburg in Minneapolis, as if you have all these different philosophies out there and you're going to choose one and you sort of float among them and look for reasons for this one or that one and which one is the most convincing, that model of reality gets abruptly shaken by the story of Lewis, who comes to faith in God and in Christ, not because he finds good reasons here and there, but he comes because the reality of God draws him. It's a little like Francis Thompson's famous poem, The Hound of Heaven, that God will not leave him alone. Now, in the course of his career, which was a career in literary criticism, he wrote a number of outstanding books in the field of Renaissance literature. He also wrote a wonderful book on John Milton's Paradise Lost. But on the side, he came to write books about Christianity. And his view of Christianity was one that he calls in one of his titles, mere Christianity, by which he means that common factor about Christianity that goes beyond denominations. He's not very interested in the differences between Anglicans and Catholics and Methodists. He thinks that there is a, not an essence exactly, but a style or a flavor or a fragrance or something that non-Christians can sense about Christians of any denomination. His first successful book was The Screwtape Letters, which was an imaginary correspondence between Screwtape, who is a senior devil, and a junior devil in trying to win back a young believer who has fallen into faith in Jesus Christ. It's a marvelous exercise in human psychology and in the sociology of the local congregation. And it also, for all its wit and humor, suggests the reality of the powers of evil, which most of our theology in the 20th century has sought to avoid, I think. Later, he wrote the Narnia stories, and those are probably his most famous books now. He wrote 7 stories for children, the first being The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Then he wrote a series of 3 space stories, long before the genre of science fiction became popular. The first is Out of the Silent Planet, which I enjoy immensely still. The second is Perelandra, which is, the first is a trip to Mars, the second is a trip to Venus. It's an imaginative recreation of a paradise. And the third, That Hideous Strength, is often not liked as well as Perelandra. It takes place mostly on Earth. He himself said that his best book was Till We Have Faces, which is also a fictional book. But he wrote many others, and a number of his books came out even after he died. That is, he had written them, but they had never been published. And in general, Lewis is better loved on this side of the Atlantic than on the other side. I had the privilege of visiting some of the Lewis sites in 1991 and again last month in July when my wife Linda was with me. She's sitting over there. We went to Oxford and visited the church where he worshiped, and we saw the pew where he always sat. He was a rather shy person, and he sat behind a pillar where most people couldn't see him. In my earlier visit, the sexton or janitor told me that he had known him quite well and that he always came in before the service was to begin, and he sat reading psalms before the service started. Those perhaps percolated into his book, Reflections on the Psalms, which is also a book about prayer. There is now a Narnia window in Holy Trinity Parish in Headington Quarry, which is the suburb of Oxford, if that's the right word, where his grave is now, and you can visit his grave, and also his house called the Kilns. It has been purchased by an American-based group who wants to preserve it, and perhaps someday it will be open to visitors. It isn't yet open to visitors. There are people living there. But it's being restored after it had gone into rather bad condition. Behind it, I saw a month ago what I'd never seen before, a pond in which Lewis liked to go swimming. Also in Oxford, of course, there is the famous pub, the Eagle and Child, or known locally as the Baby and the Bird, the Bird and the Baby, sorry, where Lewis met with J.R.R. Tolkien and Charles Williams and others who called themselves the Inklings, and they read to each other there the stories, which later were published and became so well known. So you can go and drink beer where Lewis drank beer in the pub. Now, coming to the book we're going to talk about today, Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer, these were written late in his life, published after he died, just soon after he died. They are an imaginary correspondence. In reading them again, I have been struck by the fact that we rarely write letters on paper any longer, and the future is going to be the poorer for not having those letters to look at. Now, I'd like to just stop for a minute. I'd like you to be able to interrupt me at any time. And my general thought is that I'm going to be reading to you a little bit from this book as well as describing it. And I invite you to jump in at any time and say, "Now, there's a great idea," or "Hogwash." Lewis wouldn't mind that. He's the kind of tough-minded person who doesn't insist that you think exactly the way he does. And he has his reasons for thinking the way he does, but he's willing to listen to you. At least that's the kind of sense I get reading through these letters to his imaginary Malcolm, who doesn't always agree with him. Now, I just wanted to stop and say, would any of you... perhaps there are those of you who know Lewis a lot better than I do. Would you like to add something to this portrait of the person of Lewis from your experience or your reading that would enrich our understanding of the person?
One thing that a college professor of mine said about him was that he was physically a very clumsy person, which I think had a lot to do with his shyness. He really considered himself all thumbs when it came to anything with regard to fixing something or doing anything.
Or playing sports.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was a kind of out of it as a boy.
Yeah.
Because he didn't play sports well.
Right. I don't know if that was because of a sickness or if it was just... And then, of course, his relationship with his brother, which was, I thought, played so interestingly in the movie.
How many of you have seen the cinema version of Shadowlands? Most of you have, yeah, okay.
Is it accurate for film?
Well, I think it's basically accurate, although it doesn't say much about his Christian faith, which is very important to him. And for the sake of the general audience, they downplay that side of him, and they bring through what I think is an authentic development in his personality from this abstract reasoning about suffering to the experience of suffering that transforms him.
Does that transformation then show up in his later writings?
Well, you heard from John about... A grief observed,
yes,
which is his cry of pain. I'm not sure, I'm not qualified to say beyond that book how it might have affected his writings. That's a good question.
That book is in the library. It's very short, so it's easy, you know, it's short to read, but it's very moving.
With regard to his trilogy, when was that written? Was it before he met his wife? Was it?
It seems to me it was in the 50s, but does someone know better than I?
His face trilogy?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you said that it was written in the midst of writing Narnia. You're saying it's later than Narnia.
I think it's later than Narnia. Narnia is from the 40s, I believe.
And how about Till We Have Faces? Is that later?
And that's late 50s, I think, or early 60s.
That, to me, that book has a tremendous amount of depth. I love that book. Mm-hmm.
And we might look there in answer to your question about whether it has transformed him into a less academic and more personable or spiritual. Now, if my computer had worked, I could have told you. I have a little sheet with most of the books and the dates of their publications, but I tried to print it upstairs and I messed up the file and it's all gone and all the information I can't get there.
I think Great Divorce was written just shortly after Rare Christianity, if my memory serves me.
Namely in the 40s?
Early 40s.
Uh-huh. Now, The Great Divorce is one, if you haven't read it, you who are fans of Lewis, have a look at that. He brings his characteristic humor and sharpness to it. It's a parable about heaven and hell. It starts out in hell, represented by this dark, gloomy, bitterly divided community, and the situation is that people can take a bus tour up to heaven to have a look. And so they go up and have a look, and they decide they don't like it up there. So all except one go right back to hell. And the point that has come through to me from that book, that it's always stuck with me, is that as we think about universalism, the idea that all people will go to heaven, which is very popular among Lutherans as well as others, Catholics and others today, in the face of harsh sayings in the Gospels and elsewhere in the New Testament, that what prevents me from asserting universalism is the divine regard for human freedom. And the point is that if heaven is a place of adoration of God, the essential characteristic being praise and adoration of God, there may be people who choose, I don't want that. I don't want to be in heaven if it's adoration of God. Yes?
The way he does it, I think, is so... I mean, he depicts the struggle of having to make that choice so clearly. It's not simply a matter of, I don't think I want to worship God today. He really depicts the struggle of, if one is going to adore God, one has to give up adoring oneself. One has to give up being completely ruled by, and forces that one doesn't know one can have power over with God's presence. Mm-hmm. And he just does such an excellent job of describing that struggle as the real struggle that it is, rather than, it's very, I love the book.
Okay, so you've got a good ad here for any of you who haven't read. The Great Divorce is the title.
Is Till We Have Faces where the Lilith story is?
The what's her?
Lilith?
I can't remember.
No, that's...
It's a Greek myth that it's based on.
It's a different view on the myth of Eros and Psyche. It's from the point of view of Psyche's older and very ugly sister.
But didn't Lewis do that too?
I think he did. But
yeah, that is a haunting story.
And is that titled Lilith?
The book is titled something else, but within it, that's why I wondered, Until We Have Faces, because it's...
So that remains an open question, where that might be. All right, well, let's move now to Letters to Malcolm. And what I'd like to do is read to you slowly from Lewis, and then invite your interruptions, and we'll get into a discussion as we go on here. I also want to invite you to think not just about Lewis, and of course we're learning about Lewis, whatever of his we read, but to think about your own prayers. And I'd like you to think about this for just a minute before I start reading. What are the difficulties in your prayer life? What problems do you face, intellectual or practical, in praying? And secondly, what have been your best moments in praying? Here's another chair. There's another chair.
We have free will back there.
We have free will, that's right. Now, Lewis may or may not address your problems or your joys in praying, but maybe he'll speak to a few of them. I'm reading now from chapter 13 of Letters to Malcolm. I've just found in an old notebook a poem with no author's name attached, which is rather relevant to something we were talking about a few weeks ago. I mean the haunting fear that there is no one listening, and that what we call prayer is soliloquy, someone talking to himself. And by the way, he of course does not use inclusive language. I'll be adjusting it when I catch it along the way, but you may be hearing man and he quite a lot here. And of course we can't expect him to use inclusive language at the time he's writing. This writer takes the bull by the horns and says in effect, "Very well, suppose it is," and gets a surprising result. Here is the poem. "They tell me, Lord, that when I seem to be in speech with you, since but one voice is heard, it's all a dream, one talker aping two. Sometimes it is, yet not as they conceive it. Rather, I seek in myself the things I hoped to say, but lo, my wells are dry. Then, seeing me empty, you forsake the listener's role, and through my dumb lips breathe and into utterance wake the thoughts I never knew. And thus you neither need reply nor can. Thus, while we seem two talkers, thou art one forever, and I no dreamer, but thy dream." Lewis remarks as a literary critic, "Dream makes it too like pantheism and was perhaps dragged in for the rhyme." But is he not right in thinking that prayer in its most perfect state is a soliloquy? If the Holy Spirit speaks in the person, then in prayer, God speaks to God. But the human petitioner does not therefore become a dream. As you said the other day, God and people cannot exclude one another as... I've got to read this in the old fashioned, I'm sorry. As you said the other day, God and man cannot exclude one another as man excludes man at the point of junction, so to call it, between creator and creature. The point where the mystery of creation, timeless for God and incessant in time for us, is actually taking place. Quote, "God did or said it," and quote, "I did or said it," can both be true. What Lewis is saying here is that there is a coincidence of human and divine action, and they do not exclude one another.
Even as the coincidence of divine action and human action in Jesus.
Yes. And that also applies to us, he says. You remember the two maxims Owen Barfield lays down in, quote, in the book Saving the Appearances? On the one hand, the man who does not regard God as other than himself cannot be said to have a religion at all. On the other hand, if I think God other than myself in the same way in which my fellow men and objects in general are other than myself, I am beginning to make God an idol. I am daring to treat his existence as somehow parallel to my own. But he is the ground of our being. Now here you see, here Lewis the philosopher. And Lewis the philosopher is running all through here. His is a Platonism, a following of Plato, which may or may not be in fashion with other philosophers. He is always both within us and over against us. Our reality is so much from his reality as he, moment by moment, projects into us. The deeper the level within ourselves from which our prayer or any other act wells up, the more it is God's, but not at all the less ours. Rather, most ours when most his. Arnold speaks of us as annihilated from one another in the sea of life, but we can't be similarly annihilated, that is, made islands, from God. To be discontinuous from God, as I am discontinuous from you, would be annihilation. A question at once arises. Is it still God speaking when a liar or a blasphemer speaks? In one sense, almost yes. Apart from God, he could not speak at all. There are no words not derived from the Word, no acts not derived from God who is pure act. And indeed, the only way in which I can make real to myself what theology teaches about the heinousness of sin is to remember that every sin is the distortion of an energy breathed into us, an energy which, if not thus distorted, would have blossomed into one of those holy acts whereof God did it and I did it are both true descriptions.
That's frightening aspect of universalism.
How so?
Well, I was thinking, in my best moments, Paul's words is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. That at those moments I can acknowledge, yes, my prayers are the prayers of the divine. But to imagine that anybody's words, who is not in love with God, who does not have a love affair with God, to be divine words, that I'm having a problem with. If I'm hearing correctly what he's reading.
I don't think he's saying they're divine words. I think he's saying that no human being can speak or be apart from God. Even the Satan cannot be or speak apart from God. So he's going to make a distinction here, which may help you. And that is, he says, we must no doubt distinguish this ontological continuity. Now there's a philosophical term for you. That is a union of being between God and the creatures, which is, so to speak, given by the relation between them from the union of wills. That's what you're worried about. The union of wills, which under grace is reached by a life of sanctity. The ontological continuity is, I take it, unchangeable and exists between God and a reprobate or a devil, no less than between God and a saint. Whither shall I go then from thy presence? He quotes Psalm 139. If I go down to hell, thou art there also. Where there is prayer at all, we may suppose that there is some effort, however feeble, toward the second condition, the union of wills, What God labors to do or say through the person comes back to God with a distortion which at any rate is not total. Do you object to the apparent roundaboutness? It could easily be made comic of the whole picture. Why should God speak to himself through humans? I ask in reply, why should God do anything through God's creatures? Why should he achieve the long way around through the labors of angels, humans, always imperfectly obedient and efficient, and the activity of irrational and inanimate ends which presumably the mere fiat of omnipotence could achieve with instantaneous perfection? Creation seems to be delegation through and through. He will do nothing simply of himself which can be done by creatures. I suppose this is because he is a giver, and God has nothing to give but himself. And to give himself is to do God's deeds, in a sense, and on varying levels, to be himself through the things God has made. In pantheism, God is all. But the whole point of creation surely is that God was not content to be all. He intends to be all in all, Lewis says. One must be careful not to put this in a way which would blur the distinction between the creation of a human being and the incarnation of God. Could one, as a mere model, put it thus? In creation, God makes, invents a person and utters or injects them into the realm of nature. In the incarnation, God the Son takes the body and human soul of Jesus, and through that, the whole environment of nature, all creaturely predicament, into his own being, so that, quote, he came down from heaven, can almost be transposed into heaven drew earth up into it. And locality, limitation, sleep, sweat, sore weariness, frustration, pain, doubt, and death are from before all worlds known by God from within. The pure light walks on the earth, the darkness received into the heart of deity is there swallowed up. Where except in uncreated light can the darkness be drowned? Now, if I try to put this in my very, I know it's hard to listen. I'll try to put this in my own words and then invite you to comment. The thought comes to the prayer, is anyone listening to me? And Lewis goes on to say, in a sense, it is a soliloquy, a one person speaking, in the sense that God is speaking through us to God's self. As we came from God and will go to God, so our prayers, and he doesn't refer to Romans 8, which we would expect him to do, the Spirit intercedes with sighs too deep for words. That's the closest scriptural passage that comes to me about this idea that God chooses not to do things by fiat, that is, not just to make it happen by brute force, but patiently, respectfully, I'm thinking of Julian of Norwich now, courteously works through us and the rest of creation to bring forth the purposes and the destiny that God has in mind. That's what I hear Lewis saying here. Now, the floor is open for your comments and questions.
Strong stuff.
I really appreciate that talking about being ontologically, all humanity is ontologically connected with God. And then he went on to say, I don't know how he said it, but that's not the same thing as being connected in will.
Yes.
And that's just a really helpful to me in terms of putting it, because of my absolute conviction of God's love for all of God's creatures and God wanting to call all people into relationship, that one cannot be without God. It's impossible, and that's a hard concept to get through sometimes with people. That's powerful to me, of seeing it that way.
Reminds me of the, I've read in several sources that people who use God's name in vain frequently, people who curse a lot, are really calling out, crying out to God. That passed through my mind. God speaking to God through the individual who is totally resistant to God, who would not use God's name in any way but blasphemy. And yet, some psychologists who say, the person who does that is, person keeps saying God all the time, God, every, three times every sentence, is really crying out. Never made that kind of connection.
They're not indifferent to God. My fear is that the expression, oh God, which has become so common, it seems to me, in the last decade or so, becomes entirely empty of content. Oh God, I dropped my pencil.
Yeah.
It becomes so trivialized. I'm worried about that. Now let me show you this book. This is a little book of 124 pages. On page 87, I'm going to read to you now, that much through the book, he has been talking about prayers of petition. This much of the book, maybe 80% of the book, or 75% of the book. Yes?
Can I just say something about the past?
Yes, surely.
It just struck me as you're reading that the little verse, God is love, which you can ponder ad infinitum, is partly meaningful because of the difference between God being all and God giving of himself. I mean, if he was just up there being all, how would he ever show what love meant? You know, he almost needed to create us and give us choice, give us will, for him to be love. You know, it's the difference between your head and your heart almost. You can have a wonderful faith up here, but love doesn't live here, it lives here. And I think God has that same split. It would be impossible for us to say God is love unless he had done something, I think, like that, which set us apart, or set creation apart from himself at the same time with the connection.
And could I put in a little plug here at the moment for all of you Lewis fans to have a look at Julian of Norwich, who unfolds that love in such beautiful and rich ways. In a very different context, of course, than Lewis himself. Now, I want to read you from page 87. The wave of images thrown off like a spray from prayer, all momentary, all correcting, refining, inter-inanimating one another, and giving a kind of spiritual body to the unimaginable, occurs more, I find, in acts of worship than in petitionary prayers, of which perhaps we have written enough, but I don't regret it. They are the right starting point. They raise all the problems. Petitionary prayers. If there's time, I'll read you where he says, it's so embarrassing, all the things the New Testament says about answers to petitionary prayers, when in actual fact, we find that our prayers are not answered. much of the time. How do we deal with this? And so as an intellect, Lewis goes at that problem in that chapter. Petitionary problems raise all the problems. If anyone attempted to practice or to discuss the higher forms without going through this turnstile of petitionary prayer, I should distrust that person. The higher does not stand without the lower. An omission or disdain of petitionary prayer can sometimes, I think, spring not from superior sanctity, but from a lack of faith and a consequent preference for levels where the question, "Am I only doing things to myself?" does not jut out in such apparent crudity. This man's choice of words is fantastic. But I wanted to read to you now the next chapter, which has to do with pleasure. Because for me, as a Christian, Lewis opens a window on the concept of pleasure that I have not read anywhere else. And maybe you have also found this in Perelandra in particular, but perhaps you haven't. And so this is one of the ideas I want very much to share with you. He writes to Malcolm, "It's comical that you of all people should ask my views about prayer as worship or adoration. On this subject, you yourself taught me nearly all I know. On a walk in the forest of Dean, can you have forgotten? You taught me the great principle, begin where you are. I had thought one had to start by summoning up what we believe about the goodness and greatness of God, by thinking about creation and redemption and all the blessings of this life. You turned to the brook and once more splashed your burning face and hands in the little waterfall and said, 'Why not begin with this?' And it worked. Apparently, you have never guessed how much. That cushiony moss, that coldness and sound and dancing light were no doubt very minor blessings compared with, quote, the means of grace and the hope of glory, unquote. But then they were manifest. So far as they were concerned, sight had replaced faith. They were not the hope of glory. They were an exposition of the glory itself. Yet you were not, or it's so it seemed to me, telling me that, quote, nature with a capital N, or the beauties of nature manifest the glory. No such abstraction as nature comes into it. I was learning the far more secret doctrine that pleasures are shafts of the glory as it strikes our sensibility." I'll read it again. "I was learning the far more secret doctrine that pleasures are shafts of the glory as it strikes our sensibility. As it impinges on our will or our understanding, we give it different names, goodness or truth or the like. But its flash upon our senses and mood is pleasure. But aren't there bad, unlawful pleasures? Certainly there are. But in calling them bad pleasures, I take it we are using a kind of shorthand. We mean pleasures snatched by unlawful acts. It is the stealing of the apple that is bad, not the sweetness. The sweetness is still a beam from the glory. That does not palliate the stealing. It makes it worse. There is sacrilege in theft. We have abused a holy thing. I have tried since that moment to make every pleasure into a channel of adoration. I don't mean simply by giving thanks for it. One must, of course, give thanks, but I mean something different. How shall I put it? We can't, or I can't, hear the song of a bird simply as a sound. Its meaning or message, that's a bird, comes with it inevitably, just as one can't see a familiar word in print as a merely visual pattern. The reading is as involuntary as the seeing. When the wind roars, I don't just hear the roar, I, quote, hear the wind. In the same way, it is possible to read as well as to have a pleasure. Or not even as well as. The distinction ought to become, and sometimes is, impossible. To receive it and to recognize its divine source are a single experience. This heavenly fruit is instantly redolent of the orchard where it grew. This sweet air whispers of the country from whence it blows. It has a message. We know we are being touched by a finger of that right hand at which there are pleasures forevermore. There need be no question of thanks or praise as a separate event, something done afterwards. To experience the tiny theophany is itself to adore. Gratitude exclaims, very properly, how good of God to give me this. Adoration says, what must be the quality of that being whose far-off and momentary coruscations are like this? One's mind runs back up the sunbeam to the sun. Now, there's a simpler sentence. What must God be like if God gives me this pleasure? What is the glory of God if I get this little sunbeam? If I could always be what I aim at being, no pleasure would be too ordinary or too unusual for such reception. From the first taste of the air when I look out the window, one's whole cheek becomes a sort of palate, down to one's soft slippers at bedtime. I don't always achieve it. One obstacle is inattention. Another is the wrong kind of attention. One could, if one practiced, hear simply a roar and not the roaring of the wind. In the same way, only far too easily, one can concentrate on the pleasure as an event in one's own nervous system. Subjectify it and ignore the smell of deity that hangs about it. A third obstacle is greed. Instead of saying, this also is thou, one may say the fatal word, encore. And where is it? I'm not going to have time to read it to you, but he has a paragraph in here and he says, I suppose it's very dangerous to say that there are kinds of prayer that God never answers. But I want to say that the prayer encore is one that is very rarely answered. In other words, we've had this wonderful experience and we want to say to God, do it again, just like that. And it doesn't happen. Yes?
I found that the way that I did that so many times when I saw beauty was to say, I wish I had my camera. You know, I just want to get a picture of this. And always disappointed in the, I mean, it was never, I'm not a great photographer. But finally coming to the point of saying, leave the camera here and just enjoy the sunset, you know. Mm-hmm. That was long and hard coming. I wanted to take pictures of everything. I have two brothers who are professional photographers, I suppose.
Oh.
But that's,
that exact thing. I'm gonna capture it.
Yes, I want to hold it.
Yes, I'm gonna look back at it.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to me that you have really brought a contrast between Julian yesterday, the intellectual, as much as you posed to Julian that she was using her mind as well. But what a contrast between this philosophical, intellectual approach to prayer. And just, to me, they're just diametrically totally different sides.
Mm-hmm. He should be a Lutheran. C.S. Luther.
Yes.
I would think the fact that C.S. Lewis traveled very little speaks to this, that he found so much, he found so a wealth of everything that he needed, that anyone needs perhaps, so close to home.
When I was traveling in England this July, both Lewis and Tolkien came to my mind so often in terms of the particularity of different places. Tolkien writes about the Shire as a very particular village. And every one of these little tiny villages that are all over England, they're all different. And every little garden in every little village is different. And every little hedgerow between the sheep on one side and the sheep on the other side is a little different. Every hill cut by those hedgerows is a little different. And that stuck with me. I don't know if it's exactly what you were saying, but it comes to mind when you say that. I think I've read here as much as I want to read. And what I get out of it, and I invite you now to comment further, is this, that it isn't particularly Christian to put down pleasure. Yes, there are illicit pleasures, but pleasure in itself should not always have that adjective in front of it that puts it down. And that all the ordinary and the extraordinary pleasures of life can be seen as an act of adoration in which we just see them as the glory of God as we experience it. Now, what do you make of that? Yes.
I think it to me it makes intuitive sense. If God is indeed our Father, I believe that God is indeed our Father and our Mother. So if God is indeed our Father and our Mother, even as I am delighted when my children experience a pleasure that's good for them, I can't imagine that my perfect parent would feel anything other than that. I mean, that is that's the model that was so strongly taught by Jesus. And that just makes so much sense intuitively.
Yeah.
I think God certainly created us as very sensual people. And that when I can take in through my senses that which is beautiful, that pleasure that comes in that, I think is a part of who God created me to be, and just engages me with God in a way that brings such joy.
At the moment, I'm just delighting in the greenness of your shirt.
Oh.
Color is part of that. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Since I started quilting, and I get crazy when I talk about quilting. The pleasure that has brought for me, and the joy, and I can't describe the spiritual journey that it has been for me. to work with fabric and color and stitching. It's just, it's a sort of ecstasy.
Hmm.
Another way you might could say it, I think, is that when we get to be concentrated too much on our work and don't take time for pleasure.
Inattention is what he called it. Yeah.
But then we are missing out on God.
Boy, do I ever do that a lot.
The phrase "the wrong kind of attention" really struck me. And there are times when I'm looking at something that I know this should really be moving me more than it is. I'm here, but I'm not here. Is one that I've often struggled with.
You should take a walk with a little child, and those kind of things really break you open.
Yeah. Having twins definitely did.
Double the pleasure.
You bet.
Does it matter if the pleasure is something that can be shared? Is that a kind of a red line to respect? Because it strikes me that the pleasures of nature are almost infinite. And one person could enjoy the view here, or a million people could, over time, of course, not all at once. But then, can it be shared? Do people have access to it? Is a question that rises.
Hmm.
But if it's only pleasure for you, is that where the problem starts?
What if you were alone in the valley?
Partly, because I'm not sure if that's the way to go, but I was thinking more in terms of the way we define pleasure so often in our society, and more as gratification, as individual gratification. Mm-hmm. And the pleasures of the individual, which are only pleasure for an individual, be they of any of the appetites that we have, I think are the problems of pleasure, because they are selfish pleasures in by essence. But the pleasures that Lewis is talking about, like the perfect example is a sunbeam, you know, at 93 million miles, one shaft of light through the clouds on a cloudy day can warm you and remind you of what he wrote. And that light is being radiated in all directions, you know, from this one sun of the millions and billions of suns. I mean, that's an example of the infinitude of pleasure. The right kind.
And the distinctness of it, the specificness.
Yeah, yes. Both distinct and infinite, shareable, renewable, sustainable, you know, all the good things. Mm-hmm. But
well,
if you compare it to the things we are massaged into seeking in our vanity and our lust and everything that we have in our appetites and so on, I mean, those, I think we have to put them in a different category pretty quickly. If they aren't shared,
I'm trying to think of a good response to your suggestion, because I'm not yet convinced that the suggestion is the right line to draw. I think that the pleasures of the bodily appetites are perfectly legitimate and are shareable to some degree.
Sure.
That is to say, I eat a crisp apple. No one else can eat that apple. I can tell someone else what it felt like to take the first bite of that crisp, cold, sweet apple. But it's fulfilling my appetite of hunger. Now, if I have sexual pleasure, I don't feel so free about telling other people about that, but I still feel it's perfectly legitimate and blessed by God, and it's part of the glory of God. But I don't feel that it's appropriate for me to tell other people about my sexual experiences.
No, but it's hopefully shared with the other person involved. So it's shared. You know, unshared pleasure might be the line.
Okay.
For the sake of argumentation.
Yes. Well, I'm not quite clear then by what you mean by share. Suppose I am the only person on the mountaintop who sees the sunbeam.
No, I think that's a dead end, because there's a lot of mountaintops, and we can go off into the angels on the head of Mabel talk here, but...
I can give an example, I think, of what John said.
Okay.
I have a little business I have now, which I've been built in the last 10 years, where I do woodworking. I retired 5 years ago from an engineering job, but I make wedding gifts and signs. And when I take a piece of red oak and I design something where I put the two names of the bride and groom together, and I rub it out and I stain it, and I start applying finishes to that piece of wood, and the grain starts coming out, and the more I apply finish, I tell my wife I'm going downstairs to pet my plaques, is what I tell her. as I'm finishing, I'm getting the satisfaction of creating this piece of wood.